Okay, check this out. I only have 3 spots left for Elevate 2025 at the time I'm recording this. Now, I only invite 10 men each year to go on this epic coaching adventure with me, so time's almost up. If you're wondering whether Elevate 2025 might be for you, know this. The men we work with have typically achieved some level of success, yet still feel unfulfilled. They're also men committed to rising above the distractions and compulsions, sabotaging them from living their fullness as men. They're eager to be better husbands, fathers, bosses, entrepreneurs, just better men in some meaningful way. That's what Elevate 2025 is for. It includes personal coaching with me throughout the entire year, alongside a select group of trustable men going through this experience with you. And we meet in person for an epic 5-day retreat in the American Blue Ridge Mountains as well. You will be challenged to go beyond your comfort zone, but that's where the magic happens. It's where real change happens. And you'll be stepping into an inspired brotherhood with men who have your back, creating deep friendships with these trustable men who will become your brothers for life. This journey will help you connect to your deepest purpose, more fully offer your authentic self and your unique gifts to your loved ones, to your community, and to the world. If you're intrigued, learn more. And if you dare, apply at brianreeves.com/elevate. Now, this isn't for everyone, but if you think it might be for you, apply now. Just take the next step. This could be one of the greatest gifts you ever give yourself, the gift of brotherhood with extraordinary men on an epic adventure in 2025. Go to brianreeves.com/elevate. That's Brian with a Y, reeves.com/elevate for details and to apply. And again, remember, I've only got a few spots left for 2025. All right, let's get into today's episode.
You think that we're farther along now than you anticipated that we would be?
Absolutely. I mean, this was back when Oprah reigned. Self-help was for women. Like, everything was about, it was for women. So it was highly feminized, and everything just was like, don't look weak, don't look weak. You could put a gun in your mouth, but right. Don't look weak. You can drink yourself to death. Don't look weak. Don't get a therapist. Don't get help with your marriage. Don't look weak. So it was just the fact that this has become normalized, and you can hear 3-hour conversations with men anywhere and talking about what's really going on in their lives. So guys that have been successful and crashed and burned and come out the other side. It's fantastic.
Welcome to Men This Way. I'm your host, Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, Reeves. I'm the author of 2 books and a professional relationship coach and men's coach since 2012. Alongside me as co-host is my lifelong best friend of over 40 years, Tate Arendt. And together we dive deep into the challenges and opportunities we're all facing in the world today. Here we have raw, unfiltered conversations about the topics that matter most to us, like intimacy, purpose, parenthood, spirituality, and much more. Our mission is to reveal the wisdom, insights, and practical tools to empower you to live your best life. All right, let's dive. Welcome to Men This Way. This is actually, surprise, surprise, drum roll. This is actually the last episode of Men This Way.
Hold on, it's not going to be that bad. I don't think you're going to get canceled.
It ain't your fault, Trip. Well, to be clear, this is not our last podcast. This is just the last podcast we're doing under that name, Men This Way. So I share that with you, Trip, okay. With our listeners. We're transitioning. Actually, next week's episode is going to be Tate and I. We're going to share, unroll, unfurl, announce the new name that we'll be moving forward with. It's a new chapter, a new era. I started Men This Way in 2018. Trip, you started your podcast. It's in 2007. Did you say
2007, 2008, something like that? Yeah.
The new man podcast the whole time.
Whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say that the flavor of it's definitely gone through eras and chapters and the things I talked about early on, I have no interest in anymore.
I want to explore a little bit of that with you. I think this is a really appropriate final Men This Way episode, man, to do with you, another man who's been doing a podcast, at least with, ostensibly a podcast for men, although I know that it's bigger than that, I'm sure. So I want to talk to you about that a bit in your journey. But I just want our listeners to know that, yeah, I mean, in the next, I don't think the very next episode, well, it'll still officially look like Men This Way. But we'll be talking about our new name. And then the podcast episode after that, we have a really exciting guest who will be our first. I almost said it, Tate. I almost said the name of the podcast.
Shocker.
You can tell me. It's just us.
It's just us talking.
It's not Trip. It's not just us.
Well, we'll tell you when we stop recording. We got to keep a little bit of, I don't want to take the lingerie off completely. Keep a little bit of mystery. All right. So, but today we are diving into a conversation that we hope may shake up your perspective on success, fear, and living boldly, because our guest is none other than Trip Lanier. I pronounced Lanier, right?
Lanier, you got it. Yeah.
Trip is a coach, author. He's the host of the New Man podcast since 2007. Props to you, man, for almost 20 years doing a podcast. That's no small feat. It's a show that's helped millions of listeners navigate the complexities of modern life without losing their sanity or their sense of humor. His book, This Will Make You Dangerous. What a great title, Trip, by the way. Great
this
title.
This book will make you dangerous, yeah.
Known for his candid, no-nonsense approach, Trip has spent over 20 years helping people break free from societal expectations and create lives that feel authentic, adventurous, and fulfilling. All right, let's dance into this. Let's jump. I know this conversation is going to be equal parts enlightening, challenging, and I expect a whole lot of fun.
Good. So, Trip, have fun.
Welcome to the last episode of Men This Way, but not our last episode.
Okay, good. Yeah, thanks.
Weirdest intro ever, right?
Yeah. I like it. You've created attention to me. I'm like, wow, it's going to happen. I'll tune in and find out.
Yeah. Well, we're really honored to have you, man. Again, I think it's really interesting. You know, we started this podcast back in 2018 to speak to men, you know, to give men access to elders and wisdom and insights that, you know, we were growing up without really wise elders and certainly not a lot of men to look up to and admire. It's like, okay, let's fill a void. And, you know, you've been on this journey, a podcasting journey, again, ostensibly for men, but I'm just curious, man, tell us a little bit about your journey, not just as a podcast host, but certainly, you know, these last 20-ish years or so that you say things have evolved and shaped. I mean, we'll just help our listeners learn a little bit more about you.
So, you know, we got to go back into the 90s when I got on this path and I had created a business for myself and got to this place where I had some money in the bank. I kind of hit a lot of the goals that I wanted for myself and went through a really bad breakup, which brought up a lot of grief from an event that happened in my teen years. I lost my mother unexpectedly. She took her own life. So essentially kind of everything I thought I wanted kind of unraveled. And I went through this period where kind of just asking, what the fuck just happened? I thought I had life figured out, that kind of early life, like, oh, I see how it works. And then everything kind of fell apart. This is really common, by the way. We all kind of go through some kind of unraveling in various ways. But coming through that, coming out the other side of that, I was incredibly curious, like, okay, what just happened? And it turned me on to philosophy and personal growth, spiritual growth. I became a retreat junkie. Like, I wanted to do all this. I got into all kinds of crazy shit in the Ken Wilber world and just went into this place of, I want to learn everything. I want to really understand all of this stuff. Through that, came across men's work, got involved in men's circles, and was challenged to become a men's group leader, which I was like, well, no, I can't do that. That's not me. I'm not one of those guys. Those guys are older. I can barely wipe my own ass.
How old were you at that time? Like when men's work really came into your awareness? And
I want to say it was late 20s.
Which is early for most guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they discover it at all, that's your really.
I went on a men's retreat in Costa Rica. And there was one guy younger than me, another guy my age, and then most of the guys were a bit older. You know, 40s and 50s. And but all this kind of in a place of now what? We kind of wanting, you know, there's got to be something more to this. There's definitely looking for more depth, more meaning, more life.
Now what? Yeah, that question.
Yeah. And so that put me on a path that had me eventually sell my little company that I had that bought me a few years to kind of figure out what I wanted to do. But I felt called to become a coach. And this was back when there was no coaching. It really was so underground. Somebody had to tell me I'd be a good coach before I even knew what coaching was. I ended up moving from where I lived in Florida out to Boulder, Colorado, and met my wife and we got married. But I was also part of a men's group there with some really heavy hitters, like some amazing, amazing men that were very instrumental in my growth, but also in the growth of so many others. They were all leaders and people that were very influential in that movement as well. And I learned so much and went just on this vertical trajectory. And as I started coaching, I'm just fumbling my way as a coach, figuring things out. And I started working with these couple of young guys that started a podcasting company. What's a podcasting company? I have no idea what this even is. One of those guys, you know, you should be a host. You should do this. I was like, can I curse? Can I say anything I want without having to worry about anybody taking away ads or something? They're like, yeah, sure. Why not? Unfortunately, that company went south, but I kept the podcast. So it was never in my intention to be a podcaster, and I still don't identify as a podcaster. I identify as somebody who coaches people, and I happen to have a podcast. But I remember I had a mentor around that time. This is before the podcast started, and I was like, you know, this is before Rogan. There's nothing out there for guys. There's really nothing out there. I mean, if you wanted to help a guy, maybe you'd give him Way of the Superior Man by David Data, but even that was really, really out there and weird for a lot of folks. And I remember just thinking, like, there's so much stuff up the mountain that is really helpful, that kind of wisdom, but it's not down here on a street level where I could really hand it to my buddies that are dealing with alcohol or issues in their relationship or whatever. Somebody needs to kind of translate this into a language and a vibe that the rest of the guys can do. Can really take in and see that it's their own. And I remember my mentors like, that's your job. And I mean, it hit me like a ton. Like it was like boom, right in my solar plexus, and it scared the hell out of me. But I knew he was right. I was like, that is my job. Like that's my thing to do. And so it's been great because at that time it was super edgy talking about this stuff in public. Like I came from music background. It was all about being cool, and this was not cool stuff. Talking about men's vulnerability and that kind of a thing. And so it just, it was a cooker for me, but it also to see it grow and see what it's become, where it's so it's much more commonplace now for guys to have so many outlets where they can get information, and this is becoming normalized. I think it's fantastic. And it's just gives me a ton of hope. I didn't think we'd be where we are now 20 years ago. I thought it'd be more decades.
You think that we're farther along now than you anticipated that we would be?
Absolutely. I mean, this was back when Oprah reigned. Self-help was for women. Like everything was about, it was for women. So it was highly feminized, and everything just was like, don't look weak. Don't look weak. You can put a gun in your mouth, but don't look weak. You can drink yourself to death. Don't look weak. Don't get a therapist. Don't get help with your marriage. Don't look weak. So it was just the fact that this has become normalized, and you can hear 3-hour conversations with men anywhere and talking about what's really going on in their lives. So guys that have been successful and crashed and burned and come out the other side. It's fantastic. We still have ways to go, but I think it's
what do you attribute to the fact that we've been able to come so far so fast?
The media, this can be private. There's a guy, like if I was on a plane back then and I didn't have a Kindle, you'd see what I was reading, right? I had to think about the title of my book. Like if this guy's on a book and he's actually reading it and he's not reading on a Kindle, somebody's going to see it. Is he going to fold that flat back, or is he going to be like, I don't know, I kind of want people to see me reading this book. Guys can have this in private. They can be informed, and then they can also feel like they belong. They're not the only ones. And that takes 80% of the pressure off right there. But I think because it can be private and this is so accessible, it's had a huge impact.
That's interesting. Cause I remember Tate, you handed me one of my first self-help books, right? Well, I was living in France, married to a French woman and fucking hating life. I was in so much pain. And you recommended the book. I was like, what, 26? The book Codependent No More but yeah. Melody Beatty. That was like eye-opening. And it's interesting. I mean, I wonder, I was just coming out of the military, and I hear what you're saying, Tripp, about like it's private. For some guys, like holding the book Codependent No More in a cafe on an airplane, knowing that other people may be judging me for reading Codependent No More, there's a time where that would have been utterly, utterly terrifying.
Take it a step further. I don't want to see me as that guy. I don't want to see me as the guy that needs to read a book like this. That's really what we're up against, is this kind of shadow element. So there's a lot of that stuff that men in particular deal with in their own way, and getting help or admitting that they need help is a big one.
Yeah. It's been fun to watch over the years. You know, there's some guys come to mind that we've worked with that, you know, we don't chase men to do this work. That's never effective. But some men have certainly, you know, have needed more persuasion, more encouragement than others. And
we've chased a couple.
We have both.
It's and a fine line, right?
It's a fine line.
It's a fine line.
And though some of the men that are our biggest fans, our supporters, like the ones who just, you know, will sing our praises to high earth, are the ones who also resisted the most at first. Because, like, you know, I think of it's this weird duality, because a lot of men, despite everything that's available, they have no idea where to start. They look into the world and they see nothing available for them. Everything is still looks like it's for women.
Yippee. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And yet, once you just take that first step, once you cross a threshold into a conversation, like, you know, listening to a podcast like this, for example, or your podcast, like a whole rabbit, whole vortex, man. It's like going through a wormhole into a whole new universe.
That's exactly right. And there were resources available in 97, 98 that were all there. All the Robert Bly stuff, all of the Iron John stuff was all there. But it wasn't, you know, well, I didn't identify as a guy from the 60s with long hair, you know, like that wasn't for me. So I see every generation kind of putting its own spin on it. And that's what makes it like, oh, this is for me. This does speak to me.
Tripp, one of the things I was intrigued by is you said in the beginning that much of the stuff that you were doing early on, you just have no interest in that anymore. Can you talk a little bit about what some of that early stuff was, and why do you think it's no longer top of mind? Why do you think it's no longer kind of something that really intrigues you as much?
Well, I think that I'll get into the content of it, but I just think it's, we move through seasons, we move through chapters, and I'm a creative person by nature. So I don't want to play the same song over and over again.
How old are you now?
I'm 52.
Okay. Tate and I are both 50. So we're right there. Yeah.
So I don't buy in that I have to stay in a certain place. I think that's something to watch out for. It's like, well, I have to stay here or else XYZ. But I just more alive, like, where's the thing I want to learn? Where am I in my development? I'm certainly not alone. I'll be a better conversation if I can talk about what I'm genuinely interested in, instead of, okay, let's talk about XYZ's again, you know, for the 50th time. But back then, I mean, what was fresh and what was new was what was going on in my men's groups, and it was largely in the men's healing space, I would say. And I think over time, what's morphed for me, and especially as a coach, is I just see myself more as a creative person. So it's like, okay, well, it can be the canvas or it can be your life. What are we here to create? And if we listen underneath our fears and underneath our scripts and our need for status, there's something that you are here to, or you're called here to create and experience. I'm interested in drawing that out and then bringing it to the world. And that runs in its own path alongside or different than healing. My wife's more of a healer. I understand. I have friends that are healing types, and I totally love it. But for me, it's like, what are we here to create? And I love that conversation. That just lights me up every time. I never know what's going to happen in any conversation.
What I'm attuned to, I guess, in this moment, it is true for me. It probably is true for you, given what you've shared about your mom, and, you know, that notion that our message begins from our messes,
right? Like there is a healing journey that we have to be willing to go through in order for us to be able to get on the other side, and then to open ourselves up for the contribution that pain allows us to make in the world. And yet living inside of that pain continually, you know, I just hit 22 years of sobriety. I haven't had a drink since 2003, but I don't want to stay in that world. I mean, like, I don't say I'm an alcoholic, although I had a problem with alcohol. And when I started drinking it, I really couldn't control how much I was having, and it was better for me not to do it. But labeling myself that way and then just staying in the world of recovery from alcohol, it was interesting and important and powerful and necessary early on. But to your point, it's important that we evolve and grow and develop, and we continue to emerge as what's possible for us, and then make that available to other people, I think is a profound opportunity for us.
And it's not like your sobriety isn't a part of your life now, or that healing isn't a continuous process for me now. I mean, I did a medicine journey not too long ago, kicked the living shit out of me, and I'm still working to put the pieces back together. It all works alongside of it, but yeah. You're exactly right. We don't have to stay in certain avenues, but it doesn't mean that, oh, I'm done with healing and I don't have, you know, that's not part of my life anymore.
Yeah.
It still is. It just, I love talking about it. If I have the opportunity and the option to talk about other things, I'll do that.
Yeah. I am curious, given the impact that you're making in the world, are there some themes that you think that the modern day man is going through in ways that, you know, men 20 years ago weren't? Or, you know, what is it that you think that men really are trying to wake up to now that's really important for them to do so?
I think it's pretty simple. I think it's always, and I don't think this has anything to do with men. I think we're always kind of, we move through a phase early on to belong and be accepted and be desired and be safe. We adopt a personality and an identity to function in that way. And that's necessary. And then we're really fortunate to start to ask deeper questions. Who am I really? And what am I really here to experience in this lifetime? And if the life that and the identity that we've created is out of alignment with those deeper questions and what's wanting to emerge through us, it's painful. If we've created a livelihood, a lifestyle, a relationship, a marriage, friendships that don't align with that, we will feel like something's wrong with us or something is missing. And a lot of times what I see people do is like, why can't I just be happy? I've got it so good. There are people losing their homes right now in Los Angeles. Like, why should I complain? And they tend to shut it down, try to distract or numb themselves. But I think there's a lot of beauty in there, and it's a place for us to find our gold. And if we just learn to see it as a level of our stage of development, that as you reach a certain stage in your life, you're going to, I'm going to ask deeper questions. I think it can bring us to a greater sense of wholeness and unity.
Trip, similar to you, I've been drawn for decades to transformational work. I've threw myself into ayahuasca in my late 20s. Went to first Tony Robbins event when I was, I don't know, maybe 23, something like that. Got a master's degree in human relations when I was in the military. Like, I've just been, probably like you, I've got some very bizarre experiences that most people would be like, you did what?
Yeah.
Who? You did what?
Yeah.
Run that back. Like, some weird shit. And I'm so grateful for all of it. And, cause it's just shaped so much of, you know,
we should do a show on that. Just weird experiences.
That would be
a pretty epic show.
I'm telling you, weird shit. That would be so much fun. We should totally do that. That's a great theme of a show.
Maybe we need to have one more episode.
The stories, man. Yeah. Oh my God. That's a great storytelling show.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm curious about, you know, it was probably, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. So I'm 50 now. So it was probably like early 40s. I'd gotten to this place where, in a way, all right, I'd climbed the mountain I wanted to climb. I got everything, not by doing my survival work, but even doing my soul work, you know, not just doing the work to make myself comfortable, you know, working a job for the money or the stat, whatever. No, man, I was doing the work of my soul. You know, I've been doing that for a long time. And like 6 or 7 years ago, I'm looking around, I'm going, man, I got the amazing woman that I waited a lifetime for. I got the dog I always wanted. I'm doing the work that I'm loving to do. I'm succeeding at least to the kind of, I've maximized the blueprint, you know, of my current blueprint of what success looks like. And now that question, now what? I'm looking around going, oh, fuck, now what? And you know, I heard this great David White, the poet David White, said something in his book Consolations, where he writes about a word, just at one chapter per one word he riffs, and there's this word ambition, and he says something in there, and I'm paraphrasing. Carl Jung said something actually similar, but something about you know, the ambitions, even the word ambition is for the young, right? Ambition can get you to the horizon, but it can't get you beyond it. I've been, even in these past number of years, been still sitting with that. Like there's this Richard Rohr, I think he's a Franciscan monk. Anyway, brilliant, brilliant spiritual teacher, talks about the first half of life and the second half of life. Like, we're men that are entering our second half of life in a culture that only knows anything about the first half of life. Right? And so I'm just curious, man, just your experience as a man. I mean, how long have you been married to Allison?
We've been together 20 years.
20 years. Do you have children?
Yeah, we have a 14-year-old daughter.
Oh, man.
Me too, man. Good luck, and I'm with you.
Yeah. I'm strapping in. These next few years are going to be interesting. Yeah.
So I'm just curious, man, from in that perspective, I suppose, of the first half of life to the second half of life. Like, you know, especially as a man whose journey I feel in many ways has been similar to mine. You know, where we didn't just start reading self-help books last year and, you know, our minds are being like, we've been in this a long time, in this conversation, in this exploration. What's different for you? What is shifting for you as you perhaps transition out of the first half of life ambitions and you're staring down the second half of life? Like, what's different for you, man? What's unfolding and evolving for you? Is my question making sense?
The presence of death, it's much more tangible that loss is inevitable and not something to be denied, like maybe folks that are trying to outrun their aging and so they just look like aliens now, right? Like this, that loss is inevitable. And I interviewed Sebastian Younger recently. He had a near-death experience and wrote about it, and he said that, and he can't find the nurse that said this, like it might not have been an actual nurse in the hospital. It's a fantastic story.
Oh, yeah, sounds interesting.
But he said, basically talked to her the next day, and she was just kind of nonplussed that he'd almost died. And she said, maybe it's not something to fear, but something to celebrate. I think there's something in that. There's something in this relationship with whether I gain significance from podcast and writing a book and knowing that that's going to be taken away, knowing that I am going to outgrow in this body and, you know, move beyond it, that everything I love, like if there's just, there's an embracing of we're heading in this direction now and I can fight it and I can act like I'm 20 years old. I'm still committed to being very healthy and strong, but there's something about this, a letting go, and it's fucking hard. Okay. But I feel that more in my psyche now of being, how often I can be reminded, can I let go of this? Can I release that? Can I let go of this? And can I find beauty in that? Can I find freedom in that? That it's not something to cling on to and hold on to. And that feels more informative in a way that I don't think I could have. Those ideas were familiar in my 20s and 30s. And like, yeah, I get it.
Right.
No.
Right. I love
but
that.
It has more juice now. It has more like, oh, we're really not going to make, we're not making it out of this a lot.
Brian, who was it that said to you recently, I keep quoting you, but totally in artfully around that starting at the age of 40, life.
I was just thinking that. That's actually my mentor, John Lee.
Got it.
Who wrote the book, The Flying Boy, and he was friends with Robert Bly. Anyway, incredible man I've been fortunate to mentee with, I suppose. He said, once we hit 40, we'll be grieving for the rest of our lives. And truly, like there's loss. We're yeah. processing loss. If we're paying attention, that is.
And what's really interesting, I've shared that with a few people, and the different responses to that have been very interesting, because most people are like, I don't want to deal with that. That right. sounds horrible.
Yeah. Mm.
But, yeah. but you know, I lost one of my closest friends in the world in 2020. Beautiful. One of the, you know, no man will cross my path quite like him ever mm-hmm. again. A guy named Jeff Bennett, who died in 2020. I mean, the
unique dude,
he man. Could fill a room yeah. with joy and life like no one else that I've ever known. He lived to be 45 years old. And his father said, you know, he lived a full life in 45 years. And sometimes I would say like he lived three or four lives. And in a world where that it becomes true, where, you know, life becomes a grieving process, you know, I'm starting to lose my eyesight a little bit. I'm not able to work out in the same way that I used to. And like, these are all small little grieving moments. And yet the alternative is that Jeff Bennett will never get another moment with his two beautiful boys. You know, like, you know, the gift of the grieving process. You know, his sister shared this beautiful thing with me right after he died, which was that, you know, grief is the joy, is all the unexpressed love that we have for people. And that the grieving process is another expression of love in the world. And so what a gift that we get from 40 on to continue to grieve. You know, both my parents are still with me. And I still get to, I was thinking this Christmas, like how grateful I am. I'm my wife's parents. They're still with us. So the grieving of those losses are yet to come. And if I'm lucky, we have a dear friend, Jonathan, who he has said that his father's last lesson to him was through his death, through his father's death. And so some of the greatest lessons that my mother and my father and my in-laws will give me yet are their deaths. And if I'm lucky, I get to experience that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what you're sharing here, and you know, the presence of death, that there's this beautiful quote that death twitches my ear. Live, he says, I'm coming.
Yeah.
So Tripp, to bring this back, to get your insight and your thoughts, like knowing that, especially men, we don't want to pay attention to the grief. We want to live. We want that. So we say, right. Which often looks like, I want to distract myself. I want to have big feelings, do big things and big accomplishments, right. Big, more. Like, nothing wrong with that. I enjoy that too. I'm not criticizing that in and of itself, but when it comes almost as a response to, I just don't want to pay attention to shit. I don't want to pay attention to, like, how do you, Tripp, as a coach, as a mentor, as a man yourself, how do you help men stay present or come into presence? How do you help men come out of these distractions, the numbing out? How do you do it, man?
They've got to have a reason. You know, I can't, I'm not an evangelist. So they've got to be drinking. They've got to be thirsty if they're coming to the river. I can't, there's no, hey, you should drink this. And I think that there's a point where whatever they're doing to distract, it's more painful. So they're typically in a stuck place, and there's kind of like the thing that used to work isn't working anymore. And that's really scary, right? And so whether it was the drinking or the pornography or the success or the money or the attention or whatever, if once it starts to become empty and it doesn't work. I mean, I interviewed a friend of mine the other day. He's a lead singer in a metal band. He said, I drank enough to kill an elephant. He goes, I was completely sober. He's like, if you took the blood out of my vein, it would say that I should be dead. But he's like, I was completely fine. And I think that there's a version of that for the things that we do to distract ourselves from ourselves, or we can't do this. And this was true for me when I was out running the grief of losing my own mother. It was that that tiger was coming for me, and there was just no other thing to do. Like, I had to, it got me. And it feels like death, but that's where the liberation comes from. there's a liberation. There's actually a relief of like, I don't have to run anymore. I can, you know, maybe you guys have done this kind of thing too, where you have a man and you go through a death process with him. And then you lay in there, we wrap a guy up in sheets and have a eulogy and, you know, say goodbye to him. You wait a few minutes, he's going to start wiggling around. There's another rebirth. There's another chapter. There's another version that comes out. It's not like, okay, we're done with the exercise now. It's like, now the exercise starts, because there's a, who are you now on the other side of this? And that's a really beautiful place to be. So to come back to being present, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but present means no longer trying to outrun this thing, like to actually turn into it. So if it's my grief or it's my shame, or if it's the truth that I'm not happy in this career, I'm not happy in this relationship, and I'm scared to death to be XYZ, I think that's the just turn it in and being willing to be, instead of defend, to be curious with that.
We deal with a lot of men that are on that precipice, that are at this threshold moment. And to your point, you can't make people drink from the well, so to speak. But for the guy that is at this threshold moment, that might be on the edge, he knows he wants to improve the quality of his life. He doesn't exactly know how to do that. You know, what would you say to the man that's at that threshold moment, that's on the, you know, he can continue doing it the way that he's been doing it. He can transform his life. He doesn't exactly know which direction to go. What would you say to that guy that's at that threshold moment?
He's not in touch with himself, or he's not allowed to communicate that. So it's all there. Me putting something on him isn't going to help him. There was a style of men's work that was very confrontational, and it was about getting in guys' face. It kind of felt like we're challenging a man, and there was a lot of that. I don't think it worked. It certainly didn't work for me. I took a swing at a guy once in a facilitation.
Wow. Yeah. Here. Yeah. That's problematic.
Like that not happening. Like you're going to meet whatever defense. Like if I'm a fighter, I'm going to fight you too. Right.
Totally.
But the one day I was working with somebody and they didn't put up a resistance and they just asked me questions. And I was a person that could run a therapist around a room for years. But someone just being with me and just understanding me and just listening to me and not letting me squirrel away, like, well, hold on, what did you mean by that? Well, I don't know if I mean you said you're fine, but the way you said it sounded a little, didn't quite sound fine. What might be going on there? Just really listening and drawing out. And there was no place for me to fight. There was nobody to do this. The house of cards just comes down. And so to answer your question, I think that there's a lot of us that are like, we've got to go and meet this force with force, when in actuality, it's like, let's just go for a walk. And it's just like wanting to relax, and it's there. It's all right there.
One of the things that I hear, that we hear most often when men come into a circle of men, in whatever format that looks like, but through the work that we do, is when a man just says, oh my God, it feels so good to know I'm not alone.
Yeah.
Right. Like just that right there. Like that I find that that's almost the first thing that's on the other side of the threshold for a lot of guys, is just, oh, I'm not alone in this. I'm not the only one going through this shit. And that sigh of relief. And there's been no coaching done. There's been no teaching done. There's been no, right. There's just, you know, men revealing, you know, what we like to say, men revealing what is hidden to bridge connection. That's all we're doing. That sigh of relief is just like, ah, whatever I paid, it was worth it. It's worth it now.
I've been in situations where you might find somebody like, no, I mean, nobody would really get what I'm going through. And it's just, you know, it's just really heavy. And I'm like, hey guys, there's 8 billion people on the planet, and we found the one guy.
That's right.
He's here. Raise your hand. Tom, is it Tom? Tom's the only guy that's ever dealt with. And sometimes that whole thing just falls down. And you're like, oh my God, right. I'm the only guy. But you could be, sometimes you could be playful with that, but it really is like, how ridiculous is it that I would be the only one?
But we've become so isolated living our lives as men that it really does feel like we're the only one, because nobody, you know, we got the armor up and nobody's really sharing what's actually going on. And we'll talk about sports and politics and girls and money and the market and Bitcoin and anything else that we can talk about. But to actually talk about what we're struggling with, what we're suffering from, why would you hold up a book that says codependent no more? I've got to read a book that has a cover that I can keep my status. Like, there's,
you put a cover on the back that says managing your large penis, you know, living a life with a large penis. You're like, hey, you want to see this? Right.
Right. Managing your wealth. What to do with all your money.
The burden of being wealthy.
I'm curious to talk with you about that, Trip, this idea of success, because I know that's core in your work around challenging the societal norms of success. How do you define or relate to or orient to success in a way that's not the norm?
I keep coming back to, if you came up with a vision and you put it on your foam core board and you got it on the wall behind you and you achieved that thing, and you arrived at that place and you felt trapped, or you felt drained, or you felt isolated, or you felt bored, or you felt overwhelmed, you wouldn't think it was successful. It might look successful if you had one metric, which was, I hit that money, or I hit the top 10, or whatever it is that you're looking for. But if you still felt trapped or drained or isolated or stressed out, something would be off. And I think that's where we get to this, oh shit, it's really like, oh, this didn't add up. I had an equation in my mind and this didn't add up. So if we talk about success, what that tells me is, if I didn't want to be trapped, I wanted to be free. If I didn't want to be drained, I wanted to feel alive. If I didn't want to feel isolated, I wanted to have genuine love and connection. And if I didn't want to be bored or stressed or overwhelmed, I wanted peace of mind. And so I look at it through that lens. I've met people that make 25 grand a year and have an abundance of freedom, aliveness, love, and peace in their lives. And I've met people that make $25 million a year and it's a shit show. They're miserable. So I don't equate having more money with being less happy. Like, it's all internal. It's all the relationship to these things. So it's more about, can I come back to what's true for me? And am I willing to relax the shoulds and the supposed tos and the have tos of who I need to be? And then just start to orient towards what gives us more of that freedom, aliveness, love, and peace.
A lot of men are really disconnected from our desire, from what we want, or we're connected to desires and wants that we don't actually want in desire. So I'm just curious, like, how do you help people differentiate between what they truly want, what they really deeply, how do you help someone get connected to that, differentiate between that versus just what, you know, they were taught they should want, or, you know, what the maybe a false part of them wants?
I, you know, to borrow a page from Richard Schwartz's IFS book, you know, I call it the boardroom in our brain, and to recognize that there's a lot of different desires in there. So that we can have conflicting desires. I love being with my wife and I don't want to hurt her, but holy shit, that waitress is super hot. And I wonder if I could get her phone number, right? We could, there's this, all of this, this, we're navigating this versus that a lot of the times. I do think that there's a way to start to listen for who is saying they want what within me. And this might be the socialization, the programming, the domestication that we learned. Oh, well, I should want this. I'm supposed to want this. Okay. Got it. And then there's the, I want this because this will make me, this will raise my status. This will help me feel more worthy. Okay. Got it. And then we can, through our own development and depth work, we can start to get in touch with, what is it I really want? What would I want if I wasn't afraid? What if I didn't have anything to protect or please or prove? I might want something different, or someone different, or another life entirely. And those can be pretty confronting. Those can be really crazy when you start to unveil those. It's like, oh my God, that would just screw everything up. But I like to leave room for all of it, and let's map them out. and see what sticks. Let's revisit it next week and see if we still have that there. What I do know is that a lot of times when we say we want X, it's a theory that if I had X, I would feel different. I would feel worthy, or I would feel free. I would feel alive, whatever it is. So a lot of times we're still pointing to the experience we want to have by thinking, if I just had that money, or I lived in that neighborhood, or that woman was with me, or whatever it might be. So I like to not just identify the thing to that we want, but also the experience that we want.
You know, one of the things that I really get, we were kind of in the world of banter. You and I were bantering, and you were making a joke, but not making a joke early on when we jumped on. And one of the things I really get about you is your playfulness and the joy that you bring to things, and, you know, joking around and having fun. And sometimes I think as men, for me, I'll just say the ability to keep playing and have joy while handling a whole lot of serious things in my life. You know, that's one of my struggles. Brian and I talk all the time as part of our men's group stuff, is like, how can we bring more play? And we literally have outsourced some of our play to one of the greatest men that's alive to us. And he's an
improv artist.
He's an improv artist expert. Beautiful soul, you know, heart-centered, incredible guy. But sometimes we have to outsource this joy. What do you like? How do you keep joy and fun and play at the center of your life? And how do you introduce that into men's lives in ways that help them feel more alive?
Well, I think it's important to recognize, like, there's we might have a temperament for play, right? Like, it might just kind of be in our wiring to be a little more serious and a little more introspective, or a little more observe. Like, I want to sit back and observe. And then there's others that kind of go about life a little differently. You know, we have a puppy. She's fucking insane. And she's not who we thought she was when we went and observed her in her litter.
Yeah, right? I got one too. The golden retriever puppy. I saw you got a little girl. I got one too, man. But she's 8. She's not a little girl anymore. But I'm with you. I see you.
Okay, so there's a temperament that the reason why I say is we might have this should, like, oh, I should be more playful. You might not be that playful. That said, we also might not be that playful if we think there's a threat. It's hard to be playful if we think we're in danger. And if you watch mammals, I'm a water guy, so otters and dolphins are my people, man. And play is what they naturally do when they're fed and fucking, and, like, they're having good times, man. Like, they're doing well enough in the world where let's go play. That's a natural thing for them. I don't know if the whole pod or the whole group does it, but play is a natural aspect of that. But it tells me that they're not under threat. As soon as the threat shows up, boom, we got to get in line and do a thing. So I think if we want to be more playful, we might take a look at, what am I thinking or am I believing is unsafe around now? Why would I need to have it buttoned up and I got to be serious and I got to be men's group leader guy? I'm not always that, like, depending on who I'm interviewing, it's not, may not be very jokey and fun, and because I'm meeting whoever I'm talking to. So, but there's times where it's just like, yep, I better get this right. I tell a story in the book, second date with my wife. It was a day date, and, you know, the first date went well. I felt really loose, like, hey, nothing to lose here, this girl, okay, we'll see what happens. And then the next day I was like, this could be something, I don't want to fuck this up. And we're going about the date, and I'm, oh, what's your favorite color, and oh, what do you think of this, you know, it's just like, just totally lost myself, and I was getting stiff or whatever. We go into Starbucks and she buys this foamy chai latte thing, turns around, aims it at me, and bumps the bottom so it shoots this foam all over me. And I remember I looked down and I looked at her, and she was just like, ha, motherfucker, like, let's go. And we had a food fight. I got my fucking thing, and I'm throwing sticks and sugar packets at her, and it just dropped that whole get it right thing. And I'm so thankful, because I would have probably spent the next 2 or 3 hours with a stick in my ass. Oh, better not screw this up.
Well, you know, as you're sharing that too, man, it's just a light bulb is going off for me, Trip, because my brain is so programmed. You know, I inherited my mom's scarcity mind, and, you know, I'm aware of it. It's something I work with daily. I've done a lot of mindset work around over the years, and I know it's a temptation that's always there. That's the brain does. The brain wants us to survive. It doesn't give a shit about us actually thriving. It just survive. And what I noticed too is, you know, my wife and I, we've gone through a hard season. Not her and I personally, but just circumstantially. We've been, life has kicked us in the nuts, me in the nuts, her in the ovaries. I don't know, but it's fucked with us for the last couple of years, man. And it's been hard for me to access joy and play. And I'm just, you know, the connection that I'm really making right now is because I've been in the sort of the hunkered down, just got to fucking get through this survival mode. And yeah, man, it's hard to be playful. And my wife is so fucking playful. Thank God for her. She did some shit. She jumped in a ice fucking cold lake in upstate New York in like February on like one of our first dates together. We'd only been with each other for 2 months, and she did it because I was Stiffy McStifferton. And she was like, I have to change shit up here. She almost killed herself in that fucking cold ass lake, man. She jumped in that just, and she told me it's because of Stiffy McStifferton over here. Like, she had to break shit up.
Right.
Oh, man. So anyway, just thank you for that. It's really, you know, making a light bulb there about.
I think humor and play gets, I remember, you know, when I was in my Boulder men's group, Boulder's not a real playful town. Everything's fucking serious. We've got spiritual growth to acquire. You know, it's just like.
Interesting.
Fuck me, man. And so play was just like, what? Like, how do we do play? But for me, it's like, that's life. When we're, that is, play is a product of wholeness. Play is a product of us being home. Play is just a natural aspect of who we are. Like, if I'm talking about the otters and the dolphins, like, it's not like, we're doing something wrong. We're fucking off. But I think that if we recognize that, we might practice. Like, there's times where I feel myself getting a little too, and I'll listen to comedy albums. And it's just like, oh, right. Now, everything doesn't have to be so serious. And it's wonderful to laugh at some of these things. It's about, can we hold the sacred and the profane? Like, can we laugh at the things that feel so serious? And I think that's healing. I think it's incredibly healing to be able to laugh at ourselves, not in a way that deflects or diminishes that, but just to put it in perspective.
One of the things that I think is true for men like you, for men like us, is that I think that oftentimes people will pedestal people in one way or another. And one of those ways is to think that, I can't relate to him because he's got it all figured out, you know? And yet what I know to be true about men like us is that we do have some things figured out, but we're also wrestling with stuff too. What do you find yourself wrestling with these days? I know you mentioned a little bit about this medicine journey that you went on, but what is a modern day wrestle match that you have going on right now?
See, I've reached a level where I don't have any things bother me anymore.
Yeah, so. Okay. And thank you, everyone, for joining us.
My wife to hear that and throw a shoe like that. That, you know, that's like the, like, oh, please, right? I think what you're pointing to is an aspect of like exoneration. Like, there, one of my coaches, Phil Stutz, calls it exoneration. Like, we're going to get to this place where we've got it figured out and we don't have to deal with uncertainty or effort or any kind of pain. And there's this place like, yeah, we've got it figured out. And I remember I was on a Zen retreat one time, and man, I was going to get enlightened. I was going to escape this fucking hell, right? This is it. I'm young. I'm fucking in. Let's go, right? Maybe not shaving the head, but we're doing this. And I remember sitting there in the Roshi being like, right. So he starts talking about the different mountains after you reach enlightenment. And I was like, wait a second.
Right. Right.
There's more problems after enlightenment. And I remember just being like, no, I almost just left. I was like, no.
I came here for something else. Right.
Let me go to Tony Robbins. Like, you know, let me go somewhere else that promises this finish line. No, this is a bummer. So anyway, to come back to what's challenging me. God, I mean, it just like feels like I'm writing another book now, and it's humbling me I'm back in student mode. I got to be in expert mode after the last book. And I got to ride a wave of, like, there's an aspect of me, like, yeah, I fucking know some shit. You know, people are asking me questions. And then now it's just, you don't know shit. And I'm being confronted with that. That's not that hard. It was hard to get over at first. It was like, oh man, this is, I got to go back to school. I got to get curious and really learn again. But I also just things of being 52 years old and being a male, and I have lots of male friends and people that I talk to, but I've been removed from a lot of the deeper relationships and the deeper brotherhood. We've all scattered in the last few years. And so it's been having access to that I miss. And that's something that's, it takes a lot more effort to stay, keep those deep relationships intact. And it's just a lot easier to just do work and family and kind of keep those things going on. And so, I mean, I could keep going, but there's quite a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Well, I can relate to definitely both of those, man. The being a student again, I too have been called back into, I almost went and got a second master's this year, but it's like too much. But I'm doing another coaching certificate program for, in Jungian depth, Jungian coaching, which is what I'm really interested in. And so it feels humbling. It feels exciting. It feels like, you know what I think about though? I think about, not to make this exact comparison, but like Tiger Woods, best golfer in the world. Every couple of years, he would work with a coach to completely take apart his swing and to rebuild it back better. But there was that process where you have to come apart a bit. You have to literally dismantle what got you to where you are. And that can be very humbling. And it can be a little disorienting, even knowing that it's necessary. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, but I appreciate that, your answer.
I could bring my wife in and she would tell you what I
need. Yeah, would you do that, please? Yeah. I'd love to. We have another hour for left schedule. We probably need many
Let's
more.
Keep that one out. Yeah,
we'll bring you both on when we rebrand into our new podcast. Wait,
all our wives, why don't we one day just hand over the podcast reins to our wives?
Oh, that'd be brilliant.
That would be interesting.
And so, the three of us just sit back and...
We'll just sit back. We'll have a fire going. We'll sit around the fire and we'll just do our thing.
Trip, I just want to just really acknowledge you as the kind of man in the world that's making a difference. That's, you know, taking some of the pain that you've had and done the work to heal it, but also be so deeply committed to having your life matter. And for you to be having the most important conversations that there are to have with other men in the world so that we can have both the freedom and the connection that we're literally dying for. And so just thank you for having this brilliant conversation, for the life that you're living, for being willing to be a student, for bringing play, for the success that not only you have and the purpose that you have for your life, but so that it makes a difference for other people, man. I'm really honored to have a conversation with a man like you in the world.
Wow. Thank you, Tate. That was tremendous, man. I'm have to replay that so I can actually receive it.
I understand. We get that. Where can people go, Trip, to learn more, to hear more, to read your book, to connect with you? How can people follow up?
Yeah, the book is titled "This Book Will Make You Dangerous," and it's available Amazon, wherever you get your books, online. And then the podcast that we've discussed is the New Man Podcast. It's wherever you go for your podcasts. And then people that might be interested in the coaching work that I do can go to triplanier.com.
And we'll put all those links in the show notes. And, likewise, Trip, I don't get to meet men often whose journey feels reminiscent of mine. You know, a lot of men, I think, come into this kind of work later in life and man, God, no disrespect or criticism for that. But it's really refreshing to get to just, you know, drop in with a man who's been on a similar journey for many, many years and who's, you know, stepped into that leadership role, perhaps reluctantly. I know I came, kicking and screaming. I didn't want to do this work. I didn't want to work with men because fuck men, you know, men are assholes. I was in the military. Fuck those dudes, you know, but boy, whoa, how much shadow lives inside of that. So, you know, but to see you, to get to speak with you now and to learn more about you and yeah, man, I echo everything Tate said and just, you know, deep bow to you, brother, for who you are. Thank you guys so much, man.
Yeah. Really appreciate that. It's exciting to meet you both and feel the appreciation. I had no idea what we were getting into today, but I feel like a deep bond. Like, hell yeah, yeah. We're going to be connected from here on out. So
yeah, man.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Awesome. All right.
Thank you, Tripp.
And thank you for helping us. So beautiful. Bookend. Close this era of Men This Way. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you guys.